You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Wow, what a weekend it was. All of the pro-bombing people that, well, they were horribly against when Obama dropped bombs. Boy, they couldn't scream loud enough. This week, the cheers of now he's presidential. I actually got a couple of those. I'm not in favor of the bombs. Wasn't in favor of them without there being a plan. And look, this administration, no plan whatsoever on anything, really. There's really no long-term thought here. We'll talk about some of that. The big weekend, the tax march, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets over the weekend. Looking at the tax plan that a lot of people are not thrilled with. There's not a lot of thrill going on. In fact, Gallup just came out with their recent survey of the Trump tax plan, of the Republican tax scheme. Just 39% in the Gallup poll say they support the law. 52% disagree. Do not like it whatsoever. Now, 39% is a bump up from the 33 that it was back in January. But still, here's the thing. You're supposedly giving everybody money. You would think if you were giving everybody money and everybody understood that they were getting money, they'd be thrilled with it. So when you've only got a 39% approval rate, you realize that most people are going, I didn't get it. Now, interestingly enough, they say 62% was the number of people who are going to see, $100. I think it's 65% of people are going to see about $100. And you go, should I be thrilled with that? Is that really what we are going to go almost $2 trillion in the hole for over the next decade? Is that really what we're going to put our nation in peril over? Is that really what we're going to forego? Infrastructure improvements that we need, healthcare spending, education spending. I can think of, if I really needed to sit down and think, I could probably think of 100 things that we could spend that nearly $2 trillion on that would be better than giving more to the very wealthy. Just kind of throwing it out there. Now, NBC News and the Wall Street Journal, they had their own poll. They show just 27% of people supported the law, while 36 said, nope, bad idea. And 43%, I don't know. Which I don't know how you can not have an opinion on this horrible, horrible tax plan. Now, the important part is, the wealth class of this country, think about it, just 39% in one poll, 27% in another approve of this. The Koch brothers and their ilk have spent like $30 million on an ad campaign to get us to really like it. So for $30 million, again, our money, because we gave that to them in tax breaks, and this is how they choose to spend it. Again, not trickling down to you and me. I would argue more going to Lear or Comcast or, you know, the big media conglomerates. Not trickling down to you and me. But still, $30 million that we gave them in tax breaks, that we now know how they've used it. In fact, they're spending it in the 30 most vulnerable Republican districts to say, you know, just how much they love the tax plan, how it's going to be great and all that stuff. Now, they're also saying that, you know, Connor Lamb ran against the whole idea, and Republicans are getting a little shaky and a little nervous. So going to be interesting to see how that all plays out. And I think we all know the tax scam was a ripoff. I think we know it was going to be, you know, this great heist. As I said, you know, when he got elected, this administration they'll make thieving administrations of the past look like pikers. I mean, these guys, they've got it down. And they've got a whole infrastructure of billionaire class think tanks and state policy networks and all of these organizations with really lovely euphemistic names like We Love Dogs and Puppies and Who Couldn't Love Cherry Pie and Eat Cake and Eat It Too, you know, all of that stuff. Only to find that, you know, they're going to spend $30 million. And guess what? We still don't like their horrible tax scam. Because I think viscerally we understand what this is. This is more of their anti-tax fetish, which enriches the rich and starves the country of vitally needed resources. I mean, and that's deadly serious. I don't necessarily need a tax cut. What I need is I need my kids to get the best education they can get. I don't necessarily need a tax cut, but I would like the roads that I drive on not to be littered with craters. I don't necessarily need a tax cut, but when I get sick or a neighbor gets sick, I want to make sure that they get to see a doctor. I mean, we can do this all day long. You know, I want the kid down the street or even my kids when they get out of high school to be able to go on to college to get a good education. These are things we should be investing in, and, well, we're not. I want kids like where I grew up to be able to have food at the end of the month. And not just macaroni and cheese with black labeling, but actually nutritious food. But we're not doing that either. I want Granny to be secure, that to know her Social Security is going to be fine. Medicare is going to be fine. I want poor kids like me when I was a kid who get sick, who get to go to a doctor, because guess what? Medicaid will be there. I want that senior who ran out of money. It needs to be in a nursing home to be able to be cared for because Medicaid is sound. And what they are doing, what our Republican friends are doing masterfully, is they're creating the debt crisis specifically to destroy those programs. It's maddening. But there's lots to get to today. In fact, I had, you know, one of the things that's been driving me crazy all day is, you know, Trump's been taking all this credit for, oh, he bombed Syria, so the Russians must not have anything on him. Only to find out that yesterday Nikki Haley was on DeFace the Nation and said, there are going to be economic sanctions coming. We're going to put them there. Only to find out today Trump said no. So I'm really confused. You bombed him. Wasn't the bombing that everyone thought it was going to be. It wasn't the shock and awe kind of stuff. Very strategic. There were some things that needed that I guess were smart targets. But we've now, I guess, stepped back. So a lot of questions. Lots of questions. And some of those, you know, around this Mueller investigation, of which today was another fun day in the saga that is Michael Cohen. And this is one of those things where you just go, you know, it's just this giant incestuous pool of a handful of really, you know, to use some of Trump's best words, slimy characters. You know, to use some of, you know, Trump's best words, lying characters. To use some of Trump's best, most wonderful words, sleazeball characters. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, today, evidently, there was a judge who decided that, guess what? Michael Cohen's attorneys filed for a temporary injunction, wanted to stop the federal government from seeing what they had seized out of his office, his home, and his apartment. Evidently, he didn't want to disclose his three clients, of which we know one being Donald Trump, the other one being Elliot Brody, who was a former Republican National Committee official. You may remember the $1.6 million payoff to the Playboy bunny or the Playboy model. He had an extramarital affair with. I guess they had a child or she was pregnant and an abortion and you know, all kinds of nuts. Three clients. We know those two. Sex scandal. Who could possibly be the third? And interestingly enough, it was baby Jesus himself. Sean Hannity was number three. And you go, wow, what an interesting coincidence. How cozy. You know, now I'm kind of waiting for Jeffrey Epstein's name to get thrown out as, you know, in part of the scandals with these children. I'm waiting for all this insanity to start coming out. And it's interesting to me that if you watched Hannity's show the last couple of, you know, the last 4 or 5 days, boy, he's been just, you know, attacking the FBI like nobody's business. In fact, he opened his show by saying the Michael Cohen raid is a declaration of legal war on the president. Now, I've talked to a couple of attorneys who say, you know, this is unusual for this to happen, but it's not wrong. It's unusual to have the relationships that this lawyer has with this president and these other characters. And I had a couple people who agreed with Comey who said, you know, this is a mob organization. And Cohen, kind of the mob lawyer. And for those of us who've watched the Godfather, they would go to the lawyer's office to have their conversations. They would go to if you watch The Sopranos, they would go to the doctor's office. I'm waiting for that goofy doctor. I don't remember what his name was. I think Berkowitz, the one who wrote that, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, the bestest, greatest patient ever, healthier than anyone's ever been. Remember him with the goofy picture? I'm waiting for him to be involved in all this to where, you know, the Donald and Cohen and Hannity and the other one were having meetings in the doctor's office. I mean, that's how crazy this is getting. You could not write this stuff and have anyone believe it credible. Honestly, truthfully, you can't write this. You can't make this up. That's how insane this is. It's how absolutely insane. Now, Hannity came out on the radio show today and said that, well, you know, he and Cohen have been friends for a long time. He did some legal work for him, but it was never involved me and a third party. Never. So I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I'm sure if there are a line of ladies out there who want to come forward, maybe the non-disclosure agreements that Cohen wrote are just as pathetic and porous as the one he wrote for Trump and Stormy Daniels. Maybe you can come forward too, because I would love nothing more. I would love nothing more than to have a line of women come forth on Sean Hannity. You know, one of these guys who, you know, talks about how pious he is and, you know, how religious he is and, you know, family man, all that nonsense. So lots of fun. And I got to wonder, because a couple of weeks ago, we had a guest on the program who threw Hannity's name out as possibly someone to be investigated by Mueller. Is this what he was talking about? Because it just seems... it seems too convenient. It seems too cozy. It seems too, well, coincidental that Hannity gets all of this access. Hannity's out there trumpeting how wonderful Trump is and attacking anyone who would say a cross word about Trump, only to find out that they share a lawyer. And a lawyer that has, well, some dirt. I got to be honest with you. I got to ask the question, what does Trump have on Hannity? I mean, stop and think about it for a minute. You got the pit bull attorney who's good at twisting arms. You got this mob boss mentality that's going on. These people live in the world of dirt. They live in the world of you know, holding things over each other. What's Trump got on Hannity? Lots of questions. Lots of stuff. Lots and lots. There's also the big court hearing today. I want to get to some of that. Just lots of stuff to get to. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got to take a quick break right here. When we come back, Tim Hogan's going to be here talking about the weekends, the big marches all across the country that happened. He's a spokesperson for the Not One Penny Coalition. Going to take a quick break. Right back with Tim Hogan. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1854. That was the day wealthy populist and labor advocate Jacob Coxey was born. He grew up in Danville, Pennsylvania, and worked as a stationary engineer in an iron mill. Soon, he moved to Ohio and opened a sand quarry. He entered politics and initially campaigned as a candidate for the Greenback Party. By the 1890s, he had thrown his lot in with the populists. When the Panic of 1893 hit, workers flooded the industrial Midwest in search of jobs. Cities across the country were overwhelmed with the newly unemployed begging on the streets. Coxey proposed a good works bill, which demanded $500 million for federal jobs. He supported paper currency, public works projects, transportation for rural areas, and full employment. He decided to take his proposal directly to Congress by organizing a protest march on behalf of the unemployed. Hundreds joined him on his march from Ohio to Washington, D.C., forming Coxey's army. They set off from Massillon, Ohio on Easter Sunday, 1894, supported by populists and organized labor. Estimates of marchers ranged into the tens of thousands. His army, however, was stopped along the way by court injunctions, preventing them from commandeering trains and seizing railway lines as they traveled. About 500 eventually reached Washington, D.C. As Coxey climbed the steps of the Capitol to demand the good jobs bill, he and his army were met by police forces, which attacked the crowd and beat them back from the Capitol steps. Years later, his campaigning finally paid off, and he was elected mayor of Massillon. In 1944, he was invited back to the Capitol steps to deliver his good jobs bill, which by that time had become official policy.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So big weekend as people all across the country took to the streets to protest the horrible tax plan, the ripoff, the theft, however you're going to put it, the Trump plan. And you got to wonder, he ran on, we're going to help the middle class, we're going to help the working class, and what'd he do? Well, he enriched his class. And I know I get people all the time, Rick, it's because you tax and spend liberals. What about the crippling debt conservatives? The ones who have given away our future so that the wealthy can have more today. What about that? And here to talk about the weekend's marches, I've asked Tim Hogan to come talk with us. He's a spokesperson for the Not One Penny Coalition. Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me on.
So all across the country, you had thousands of people out in the streets. What was going on?
Yeah, so this year was the one-year anniversary of the tax march, which we started in April of 2017 on Tax Day. Our original demand was to see Donald Trump's tax return. That is still one of our demands. But our focus has shifted a little bit now that the GOP tax law has started to take effect. And this swell of grassroots support from activists, elected officials, community leaders across the country is pretty incredible. We had more than 100 events happening coast to coast to hold Republicans accountable for forcing the tax law through Congress and demanding that they repeal it. You know, we were told over and over again that this is good for the middle class, but the reality is that that 83% of the tax breaks in this bill go to the richest 1%. It does nothing to unrig the system. It further rigs the system. And people are rightfully upset. They are still taking to the streets, and we are going to hold those accountable who voted to support this terrible law.
Yeah, and as I understand, you guys are putting billboards up in 30 Republican districts, you know, to let people know how much they individually are going to benefit from this tax law.
That's right. Yep, we went up today, actually, with 30 billboards in congressional districts across the country to outline how members of Congress are actually using this law to line their own pockets. And that's just, it's textbook corruption. You know, when they were finalizing the bill and looking at how they were going to calculate pass-through income, people started paying attention to what was known as the Corker kickback. And Bob Corker, Senator Corker, sort of became the face for how this bill could be used to benefit people who are involved in real estate or have a certain way that they run their business. But it's not just him. It's members of the Republican Party from across the country. It's, you know, Mike Rogers, Doug LaMalfa, Justin Amash, Mike Kelly, Tom Marino. It goes on and on and on. Ron Johnson, Lamar Alexander, Rob Portman. And they are, some of them are pocketing over $1 million, and many of them tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And this isn't really something that's been examined, but it's just another example of how the massive payday for this tax bill wasn't for the middle class. It was for those who are already doing well and didn't need any additional help.
Yeah, to steal a Nancy Pelosi line and tweak it a little bit, the more we find out about it, the more we really don't like what's in this. And you were right at the beginning. You know, you said they forced this through. I would like to use a Tea Party frame if I could. They rammed it down our throats, Tim.
Yes, they did. And it was a process that had so little input from the middle class. It was so unpopular. You touched on this a little earlier. It was so unpopular when it was making its way through the legislative process for good reason, because people do not, if you tell someone you're going to get a tax cut, sure, whatever, I'm going to get a tax cut, that's great. But what rightfully pisses people off is, oh, I get $1.50 and the wealthiest Americans are going to walk away with tens of thousands of dollars, and you're going to use that as a pretext to start cutting my Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. It's terrible. And the process that they went through, you know, there were over 6,200 lobbyists. 57% of all the lobbyists in Washington lobbied on this bill. And so who is this bill written for? It is not written for the middle class. And it is written for the special interests who can afford those lobbyists. It is simply, you know, not for working families.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I like the way it was written. You say it was written for. I would argue that it was written by lobbyists.
Yes, it was. It was written by lobbyists, almost quite literally. I mean, you remember when the bill was going through final passage, we had notes scrawled in the corners of the piece of legislation. And, you know, there are we're starting to see the effects of what that means for our larger economy, too. You know, we are seeing that corporations are the wealthiest corporations are averaging about $5 billion a day in corporate stock buybacks. That does nothing to help the middle class. All that does is help CEOs who, you know, now we've just learned the other day, have a medium average pay in the United States of about $15 million. So they're doing okay. All it does is line their pockets, because a lot of their bonuses are tied to the performance of their stock.
Right.
It helps them, and it helps their wealthy shareholders.
Yeah, but Tim, it'll all trickle down to us. It's gonna be great. Eventually, it's gotta trickle down. Eventually, their pockets get full, and something's gotta spill out. Tim, come on. Eventually, if we just did it enough, eventually something will fall out.
Yeah, decade after decade after decade, I feel like we've heard that, and we just haven't seen it yet. But maybe if we just, you know, loot the entire federal government, then at that point, maybe some of it will start to trickle down. But it's not, you know, it just isn't. And it's just an economic reality that, you know, a majority of American workers aren't seeing a benefit from the tax plan. And there are study after study saying that it's, you know, not likely going to spur investment to create new jobs. In fact, you know, one of the most egregious explanations we got was from the CFO of Kimberly-Clark. Once the bill passed, their spokesperson said very clearly, oh, no, we're going to take these tax breaks and actually invest in laying people off. So, you know, we're seeing companies lay off workers, pocket their tax savings. We're seeing oil companies, big pharmaceutical companies, get billions from the tax law. And are those pharmaceutical companies doing anything to lower the cost of prescription drugs? No. Those benefits are not trickling down. They never have, and I wouldn't expect that they will anytime soon.
But here's the thing. I mean, in the very short time when they were maneuvering to ram this down our throats, I was arguing exactly what has happened. You're going to see massive stock buybacks. The wealth class is going to get wealthier. You're going to see foreign investors overwhelmingly take a large chunk of it. It's not going to trickle down to the rest of us. And there are going to be massive layoffs. Why? Because we've seen this movie before. You go back to the George W. Bush years, we saw this happen. They did the exact same thing back then, and the exact same thing happened. So why are we surprised? I guess the difference, because there is a slight difference here. There were a handful of bonuses that were paid out as kind of a PR stunt to get us to think, oh, we got something. Kind of like the Bush Prize when they sent out the $300.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, that is true. That was I will give them credit that was a very well organized PR campaign. But at the end of the day, only about 2% or less of the workforce saw a benefit from those bonuses. And you know, you go from case to case, and there's always sort of a hook. You know, oh, you want to get the full $800? Well, you must have worked the company for a full 20 years. At Disney. They were actually using those bonuses as leverage to get concessions out of the union. So there, you know, there's a fuller story to tell there. And part of it, too, is not just the inequality of this bill, but that it has effects on people beyond their immediate paychecks. You know, people forget that, you know, you repealed a portion of the Affordable Care Act in the tax legislation that is going to result in 13 million Americans losing access to affordable health care. That in the long run, because of the way that they structured reducing deductions and capping certain things that a lot of middle-class families rely on, that 53% of American families are going to see tax hikes once this plan is fully phased in, despite Republicans saying that this is going to be a middle tax class tax cut. And the CBO even said that this plan is going to increase healthcare premiums by 10% every year. So it is a disaster. It is exactly what you said. We've seen this over and over again. We saw it with George W. Bush and previous Republican administrations. And I can't stress enough, too, that this is just a pretext that we see them continually use, that we're going to add $1.8 trillion to the national debt, and how are we going to pay for it? We don't care about losing that revenue through tax cuts. What we will do is try to make up for it by cutting Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. And you saw it last week. I don't think this is going to go anywhere, but you saw the House Republicans try to pass a balanced budget amendment. Well, okay, you want to balance the budget now that you've looted the federal government.
Yep.
It's just a pretext for gutting critical social programs.
And the good thing is I think the American people are kind of, I'm hoping, wising up. I mean, I just talked about the latest Gallup poll. Just 39% of people in their poll said they approve of the tax scheme. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll, just 27% approve of this piece of garbage. So I'm hoping that people are seeing this, and that as we continue down the road, it gets It gets worse because I think what you guys did over the weekend, having people out in the streets, raising awareness, talking about how bad this is, can only move us, hopefully in November, closer to coming back to sanity.
Yep, I completely agree with you. I think what we're seeing is a lot of energy in the streets. And I would say, too, you know, what is our test case right now for, is this bill some sort of electoral salvation that the Republicans are trying to tell us that it is, that they're going to run on this and it's really going to help them in the midterms? Well, the one test case we have so far is Pennsylvania 18. And they ran, and spent millions and millions of dollars going after Connor Lamb, trying to tie him to Nancy Pelosi, and also saying, you know, he wants to raise your taxes. By the end of, and Connor Lamb, to his credit, stood up and said, no, I'm not for this tax scam that puts us deeply in debt and is a giveaway to the wealthiest Americans. And at the end of the day, they took that advertising down. Their advertising from the Congressional Leadership Fund, from Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, those dollars no longer were spent on ads selling the tax bill because it wasn't moving anybody. And at the end of the day, not one penny, we actually went up with an advertisement on radio in that district going on offense on the tax bill. So I think Pennsylvania 18 was a good sign of things to come. The polls that you cite, you know, there was a little bump after the bill passed. It's just what happens. Once a bill passes, people think of it as a winner for a little bit, but we're starting to see the effects. And that bump is now being deflated. People are coming back to where they were, and they just have no appetite for this toxic bill.
Yeah, so where do you go from here? I mean, you had all the energy for the weekend. In fact, I saw there are some events today and some even still for tomorrow, which is actually tax day. What are we hoping for in the coming weeks and months as we go towards next year?
Yep. Well, we've actually got about 40 events still going on throughout this week. We have had people who wanted to coordinate things beyond just Sunday and beyond just the tax day tomorrow. We're having a rally on Capitol Hill with Senator Schumer and Leader Pelosi and other members of Congress who are going to come rally in support. We've been doing a repeal the Trump tax tour across the country, from California to Florida to Minnesota, Iowa, Arizona, Nevada. We've been across the country, and we're going to keep that energy up, and we're going to just continue to call out Republicans where we see them being hypocritical. And, you are seeing them talk less and less about this tax bill, whether it's because they just can't break through the chaos that Donald Trump is creating, or they're seeing the writing on the wall. And notice that Paul Ryan's retired, despite having his so-called legislative accomplishment, passed through the Congress. I just don't think they have much, but we're going to continue to hold them accountable in every way that we can.
Oh, I'll tell you, I sure hope they run on it in November. I hope they run on "We made the wealthier wealthier." I hope that's their campaign slogan.
Right, exactly. It's not too compelling.
So the other side of this, you know, last line of questioning, because you know this all comes back to elections matter. What do the Democrats run on? I've been saying for a very long time we need a very progressive income tax. I would say emulating the one that Ronald Reagan took over, or maybe even the one that the good Republican socialist President Dwight David Eisenhower had.
Right. Well, I think there are a lot of things that Democrats can run on against this Republican agenda. I think economically we can start with repealing the most obvious and egregious tax giveaways to the super rich and corporations. Let's fix those parts of the tax code. That means things like a fairer estate tax, repealing the Trump loophole and the provisions that created the Corker kickback, reinstating a strong minimum tax for the rich, or a corporate tax code that doesn't preference people who do outsourcing and offshoring, and, you know, closing special tax breaks and loopholes in the current code for little things like for golf course owners and hedge fund managers and oil companies. Those are things we've been talking about for a really long time, and I think there is a populist energy out there that Democrats can definitely latch onto and harness. And, you know, if there are voters out there who thought maybe Donald Trump was the answer in some way, that he was different, that he was going to come to Washington and shake things up, I mean, after a couple of years, after I would say a month, but, you know, once we get to the midterms in November 2018, it's just so clear that he was just a wolf in sheep's clothing, that he has done the same things that Republican presidents have done in the past, but he's just been much more blasphemous and boisterous about it and much more dangerous. So, you know, whether that's stocking his cabinet with Wall Street insiders or pushing for legislation that has nothing to do with helping the middle class. It's pointing out those things, I think, really latching onto a true populist agenda that'll help the middle class.
No,
that's what Democrats need to do.
No, you're absolutely right. And I remember asking right after the election in November, and asking some of my labor friends, you know, how are you planning to take advantage of the anger that's very real and that's out there when Trump fails them? Because as you pointed out, there's still tax breaks for offshoring jobs. And that was one of the things he ran on that would never fly under his administration. He only made it worse.
Right. Absolutely. Yep. He is at best a con artist and, has done so little to help the middle class. And I again, just going back to Pennsylvania, I've seen a district with, you know, core, very strong unions. I think across the country, labor is awake and that they're ready to engage in 2018. We're going to be standing right there with them side by side.
Good stuff. Where should people go to get more information?
They should go to notonepenny.org, and they can learn more about the different activities we're going to be doing in the weeks and months to come, and sign up for the emails that we send out and join our group.
Good stuff. Tim, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Tim Hogan, spokesman for Not One Penny. And again, take a look at their website, notonepenny.org. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2000. That was the beginning of a two-day rally in Washington, D.C. to protest the gathering of world leaders for the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or what is known as the A16 Summit. The event was a continuation of the massive protests that disrupted the World Trade Organization's meeting the year before in Seattle, Washington. The common thread through these protests was a concern over how globalization of world markets hurts working people and the environment. Protesters included a wide range of people, including peace activists, environmental activists, anarchists, and union members. 2 days before the D.C. protest, organizers held an international forum on globalization at the Foundry Methodist Church. 2,000 people attended this teach-in to hear from activists around the globe. It's estimated that 50,000 people attended the D.C. rallies. One big theme for the rallies was bringing attention to the negative consequences that can occur when developing countries receive economic bailouts. The strings attached to these painful bailouts often usher in destructive privatization schemes and painful austerity measures that disproportionately fall on the backs of working people. The protesters in the U.S. Capitol were met by a large police security presence. The D.C. police were determined that the protesters would not interrupt the meetings like they had done in Seattle. More than 1,000 people were arrested. These protests, from Seattle to Washington, D.C., demonstrate a growing recognition of the devastating impact globalization has on the lives of regular people. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a bad case. I'm turning it up. It's getting cold in here, so fire it up. I got a bad case. I'm turning it up. It's getting cold in here, so somebody fire it up.
So the weekend's tax march highlighted the assault on working people and especially the poor. As our tax code, again, is terribly skewed in favor of the extraordinarily wealthy, and more so now, now that the Republicans have delivered on their campaign pledges to their wealthy donors by making our tax code even more lopsided and our deficits and our debt even more outrageous and soaring higher. You know, I guess now would be the time that you talk fiscal responsibility. I guess this is how Republicans do it. We give away a boatload of money, and then we say, hey, we're broke. It's time to be fiscally responsible. We've got to tighten our belt. Austerity, it's time. Because, you know, we're broke, right? And look, we're already hearing calls for entitlement reform or welfare reform or Medicare reform or Medicaid reform. I got to be honest, I'm kind of tired of hearing the word reform, because every time I hear it, I think deform, destruction, damage, death, ripoff. I think a whole bunch of things. And yes, they are literally talking about taking food from the mouths of children. Remember, this is the party who loves the preborn, but they don't give a tinker's damn about the ones already here, because after all, children do have the highest rates of poverty of any age group in this country. But we love the children. Love the children. And here to talk about his recent piece, the Republican Poverty Agenda, more job training, more pee. I've asked Art Delaney to come talk with us. He's a HuffPost political writer, reporter over there at Huffington Post. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So more pee, huh?
Yeah, more pee. I'm as surprised as you are, but it's been a real obsession since the welfare reform days, and especially since about 2011. And I honestly thought that it would dissipate, that it would go away as a policy goal, but it has not.
No. Look, I got to tell you, I think there are people who have campaign donors who run drug testing companies. I got to think that's what it is. Because, look, I mean, the places that have done it haven't really caught anyone, but it's been a real boon for the companies that process all this stuff.
I don't think it's a crony deal like that. I think it reflects an ideological desire for workers to have less power. And there's this sort of symbolic ritual that you can make people do that is sort of humiliating. And I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
And
also to put another obstacle in the way of being able to access those benefits. And it's a perfect winning situation, because look, I drive a truck for a living sometimes. And you know, I'm subjected to drug testing all the time. So what you've got is you've got the working class going, well, I've got to do it. They should have to, too. So it's almost like another one of these moments where it's a perfect opportunity to divide the working class.
That's right. And I think that response is incredibly common and really powerful. I hear it all the time when I write about this, that why shouldn't someone who's getting some kind of benefit just because they're poor not have to do the same be subject to the same indignity that I am in my job. And people don't think that much about the indignity of the drug test, but it takes a really private function. It makes you do it for the government or for your job. It's very weird. Antonin Scalia called it in a Supreme Court decision a sort of immolation of a person's privacy and dignity. And I thought that was a powerful way of putting it.
Yeah, but you know what they've done, and look, I give Republicans credit because they have really taken the Jay Gould quote to the next level. I mean, Jay Gould, the railroad magnate from the 1880s, 1890s, who said, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. Republicans have figured out how to use that on every issue. They've figured out how to pit us against one another.
Right, and where this comes from, there's no data saying that, you know, widespread drug use is hurting our labor force. That is something that this kind of policy, you know, drug tests in return for food stamps, would really alleviate. They say it's because we talked to a business in our district, and they said they couldn't find any workers who could pass a test and take these jobs. And what you're really talking about here is getting workers to put up with drug testing and take jobs for which they might not want to do the work because it doesn't pay enough.
Right.
And it's essentially an effort to reduce what economists call the reservation wage of workers, which is the lowest amount of pay that a person is willing to accept for a given type of work. That's reservation wage. And I think the drug testing, but also the job training, things that make it more difficult to obtain income support without being in a job. This is all about increasing the supply of labor, which reduces its cost. And there's various ways to do it. The job training, the drug testing are two of them. And they're not that likely to succeed with this, but it's remarkable that that's where – it's interesting that that's where Republicans are at after that whole populist presidential campaign that had supposedly completely scrambled politics. It really didn't.
No, no. I mean, they're the same as they were. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, we were talking about this. I go back to the Clinton era where they passed welfare reform, and you ended up, telling a whole bunch of people, now you got to go out and get jobs. And you flooded the low-wage market with a whole bunch of people who, couldn't take the jobs, had a whole bunch of child care issues, had a whole bunch of problems. And you ended up dropping the floor of the salary. And I remember at the time, the McDonald's near us was paying $10 an hour. Welfare reform came $5.15, back down to minimum wage. And to me, that's really what this is really about. It's about, completely flooding the labor pool so that while unemployment is at historic lows right now, wages never go up.
That's right. And I think that that's a plausible explanation. Or at least it partly explains why we've had the stagnant wages that we've had over recent years. We have no cash welfare. We essentially abolished it in the 1990s. And people were like, oh, well, that was a success. But no, really, it wasn't. It was not as if you could take that away and there'd be no consequence. Plus, expanding the earned income tax credit could also have reduced wages by making people more willing to take work that paid less because they knew the government would kick in springtime with this tax credit. So the government has done a few things that have probably reduced reservation wages all around for the past 30 years. And our policy is not going in a different direction. It's still to try to make these programs less generous.
Yeah. But what do you say to the person who goes, I prescribe to this theory of thought, too, that everyone, you go back to, I think it was LaGuardia when he was mayor, said, if you want to work, if you want to eat, you got to work. We've got this mentality in this country that everyone should put in their 40 hours. Everyone should work. What do you say to the person who goes, that's what we should have. Everyone should have a job. I think he hung up on me. because, that's one of those things that has come up a couple of times in that the reality is when you have these kind of programs that you go, here's a couple of dollars for you, but we're not going to give it to this guy. You end up creating that division. And that division is what, it creates this tension. And I think we got Art back on the line. Arthur, thanks for getting back.
Thanks for having me back.
As I was asking, there are folks who say, Arthur, everyone should work. If you want to eat, you got to work.
Right. Well, that's why work requirements is such a strong term for what this policy really is, which is simply a time limit, a cutoff on benefits. If you don't work, if you get a job, you're not going to qualify for them anyway. Supposedly, Republicans want to make it so that you could enroll in a state training program in order to fulfill this requirement. But all it really does is kick you off benefits, it ignores the fact that, according to research, the people who are enrolling in food stamps typically do work both before and after the time that they're enrolled. It's not as if everyone who gets on there receives benefits for years on end. They're like, oh, we made it. We got our food stamps. We'll never work again. So it's a sort of unfair portrayal of how the benefits work. It's not something that you sign up for and you're set for life. We know that people cycle off benefits, and they typically only get them at a low point in their earnings.
Right.
No,
I go back and I think about my mother. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and my mother and I were on and off welfare. It wasn't welfare then; it was ADC, aid to dependent children. And she was on and off food stamps. You know, we get a job. In the 1970s, we're not really friendly to single women. She would get a job, something would come up, she'd lose the job, and it was this constant cycle, like you've pointed out. And that happened, you know, virtually everyone in our neighborhood. Because one, you know, we weren't on the bus line, so good luck. There are only so many jobs you could get. Two, childcare problems, only so many jobs you could get at certain times. So there are all of these other things that play into this. And the other part of it, it's not like these food stamp benefits are all that generous.
Oh, it's $125 a month on average per person. It's not enough to actually pay for all the food a typical person would eat. That's why it's called supplemental. But it, you know, it still can, by making people less desperate, cause them not to take jobs out of desperation, which you'd think would be a good thing, but is not treated that way by policymakers.
I've often said that, and I find it interesting that, you know, the right wing, they shame middle class mothers for going to work. And women who are in poverty who can't go get a job because they've got children to raise, they shame them as well for wanting to stay home with their children. It's this weird kind of bizarre mentality.
I think the fact that children have the highest poverty rate of any age group in the U.S. is a highly underrated national problem. And this kind of policy works in the opposite direction from helping with that, because we know there aren't the sort of flexible arrangements with typical low-wage jobs where you can maintain your attachment to that job and also take care of your family. If you've got like a child care crisis, that's it. You're going to lose your job, and you're more likely to be out of the labor force long-term as a result of that. And this kind of work requirement process would set up a bureaucratic process that would make it more difficult to maintain that connection to income support to help you feed your family.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Though they're trying to target people who are not parents of the youngest children or who have dependents. But at the same time, what they would do in this proposal is to expand the categories, the demographics of people who would be subject to this requirement. It already exists, is a funny thing about this, and they're just trying to expand it. It's not as if there is no quote-unquote work requirement in food stamps as it is.
Right. No, and it's once you open the door and they keep opening it wider and wider until eventually it's across the board. And look, I'm not against the idea of a work requirement per se if there was actually work available. I mean, you know, again, I go back to my experiences as a kid growing up. There weren't jobs around. So if you were to say there's a hard and fast rule here, there's no way to get to the jobs. The public transportation in this country is horrible. Child care for low-wage workers is even worse. The idea that you're going to force, single parents into a scenario that, or even, people who are struggling at the bottom into these scenarios is just kind of insane unless you've got those supports there to help as well, like decent public transportation, like child care. Look, I'm in favor of, hire people to watch other people's kids. That'd be a good start.
Yeah, that's right. And I've interviewed current and former food stamp recipients who have been cut off by the work requirements that exist today. And those have been waived during the Great Recession and then were coming back on in state after state. And it was often things like, they wanted me to provide an invoice to prove that I'd done this work as a housekeeper. And it totally freaked out my clients. Or I was not able to find transportation to the one office in my county where I could fulfill the requirement by, performing work search under their watchful eye. And these people said they were hungry and that they lost weight. It's not as if they are, I know we have an obesity epidemic, but it's not as if people just have so much food lying around that these benefits are totally superfluous. The policy does actually result and people experiencing hunger in some situations.
Oh, it's not hunger anymore, Arthur. It's food insecurity. We're no longer hungry anymore. We're insecure.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of trash talk on the war on poverty, but you know, one thing you can say for it is that there isn't the kind of starvation that people actually died from that there was back when, you know, food stamps was not a national program and like racist jurisdictions were allowed to completely exclude black people, for example. I mean, it's a program that works. And we have food insecurity instead of starvation. I mean, you shouldn't really need to have either of those in a rich country, but there is, pretty substantial threat of food insecurity, and this is the population that would be vulnerable to it, the people who would be subject to these requirements.
Yeah, I just find it quite ironic that you've got a boatload of millionaires who are in our Congress who are literally looking to take food out of people's mouths. It's amazing to me, but not surprising. I mean, you know, this has been their policy for a very long time. It just is. So in the coming, you know, because look, we just gave away a huge amount of tax money, almost $2 trillion over the next decade. We're going to go deeper into debt. We're going to pay for it somewhere. You know, so some people are just going to have to tighten their belts.
Well, here's a funny thing that's happening with this one. So the Republic, the last food stamp bill was 4 years ago, and it was Republicans wanted far more aggressive cuts that actually would have saved tens of billions of dollars. And Democrats were like, okay. And they basically went along with it. This time, Republicans are actually pushing for far more modest cuts that they are not even, that they're saying would not actually save billions of dollars. But Democrats are saying, no way. As far as I can tell from interviews and what members are saying, Democrats are completely unified in opposition to this. So something has changed. You know, perhaps it's just because they think that a blue wave will give them control of the House and they won't have to deal with anything like this at all. But it's a notable difference that Republicans are seeking a more modest change. The Democrats are more unified in opposition to it than they were in 2014.
Or it could be the farmers are screaming that, because at the end of the day, it's basic economics. You give people at the bottom money, they spend it. They put money into the system and it rises upward. It's a huge, really, you could argue that the food stamp plan is also a huge giveaway to big agribusiness.
The way the system works is you give people money to spend. You don't have this giant bureaucracy that does it for you. So, yeah, all the money goes straight to grocery stores and food producers. And farmers are a huge supporter of the food stamp program because their farm subsidies, their agribusiness subsidies, just happen to be attached to it in Congress. And they are in a lot of trouble because commodity prices have been so far down and Trump is potentially launching a trade war that, you know, since farmers export a lot, they would be vulnerable to. So that's another reason, perhaps, that Democrats feel like they have leverage because they know that food stamps is the ticket here, not farm subsidies. And farmers are looking at Republicans like, come on, don't screw us over here.
Yeah. Either that or hopefully the Democrats found their spine. There's a lot of hopes here. So what are you paying attention to? I mean, last line of questioning, what are you paying attention to as this goes forward? Because it's your view, I think you said, that you don't think it's really going to go anywhere. What are you watching for?
Well, so it's the food stamp piece is part of what's called a farm bill. They're going to mark it up on Wednesday. So the Agriculture Committee could vote to pass it out. Republicans can do it without any Democrats. But then the big question is what happens after that? Will Paul Ryan bother bringing this to the floor if all the Democrats hate it and the conservative House Freedom Caucus hates it because it doesn't cut food stamps enough? In that scenario, I don't think Republicans could get it through the House, in which case you've basically got a stalemate that could carry over until next year, result in a one-year extension of current farm and food stamp policy. That's what I sort of think will happen, barring any changes by the agriculture chairman. So I would look for that after Wednesday to see what is Paul Ryan going to do. Will he bring this up for a vote, or will they just sort of wave a white flag?
Let's hope for, you know, I've been saying it for a while. I'm hoping for status quo. I'm hoping for the gridlock that the Republicans brought us for 6 years under Obama, because then maybe nothing really horrible is going to happen.
You can thank the tax bill because they used the special fast track budget process, the budget reconciliation.
Right.
They used that, and now they don't have it. Nope. They don't have another budget. So
good point.
Since they use it for tax reform, they can't get around the Democratic filibuster in the Senate.
There you go, Arthur. I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good stuff. Arthur Delaney, reporter over at Huffington Post. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.